Good morning, I'm Tommy Howe, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9, a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program for the listeners of FM 94.9 and San Diego and all of Southern California, from the beaches to the mountains to the deserts. This is Tree Huggers International. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. Legislation was recently signed into law which greatly revamps the ability of National Park visitors to carry firearms with them into National Park Service areas. The new laws overturn a Reagan-era policy from the 1980s which required firearms to be unloaded and locked away in a secure space, like the trunk of your car, while in a national park or wildlife refuge, provided the user wasn't legally licensed to hunt in season or was about to set out on a hunt. Even before the Reagan-era re-endorsement of this rule, these long-standing regulations dated back to 1936, and they grew out of concerns about illegal hunting and poaching in national parks, but there was a public safety component as well. The regulations basically asked you handle your weapon in a national park the same way you might if you were driving down your street. You don't have your weapon out, and you don't have it loaded. If you have a firearm, you basically treated it as if you're going into any other federal building, like a post office, when you went into a National Park Service visitor center or ranger station. You left your weapon in the car or at home. That has now changed. The new rule regarding guns in national parks was added onto the credit card reform bill by Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn, a longtime supporter of overturning the Reagan-era rule, and even with the new amendment to the bill, the legislation rapidly passed both houses of Congress with barely a debate and was signed into law by President Obama in May. Starting up next year, park users will be able to carry concealed, loaded weapons into national parks, in parking lots, campsites, on the trails, in the backcountry. National Park Service employees and retired rangers by a wide margin are vehemently against the new rule, and they've been so for some time, arguing allowing people to pack loaded weapons will alarm families and could dangerously escalate conflicts between visitors or with park staff. As a former state parks employee myself, I agree wholeheartedly with the assessment of these National Park Service professionals. Poaching also remains a problem, causing the decline of a number of species in parks over the years. And with the loaded gun ban overturned, park rangers now no longer have the authority to question individuals about their weapons. Now, critics of the Reagan-era rule just overturned have failed to cite any meaningful crime statistics which warrant park visitors actively arming themselves for self-protection. In fact, the number of crimes reported in the nation's national parks, few as they are to begin with, have dropped by 25% just in the last decade. On the other side of the coin, there is some good news regarding national parks here in California and elsewhere in the U.S. A significant number of national parks will be waiving their entrance fees for weekends here and there this summer, and stimulus money is slowly making its way into National Park Service budgets and into long-delayed restoration and maintenance projects at last, giving Park Service officials the opportunity to enhance some of the necessary infrastructure at America's most treasured places. And joining us today to talk about the National Park Service, all the way from 29 Palms in Riverside County, is Mike Cipra, the California Desert Program Manager for the National Parks Conservation Association, also known as the NPCA. The NPCA has been out in front advocating for national parks and National Park Service employees for years, and we are thrilled to have you here, Mike. Welcome to Tree Huggers International.
Hey, thanks, Tommy. It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation to come on.
You're very welcome, and I want to talk about guns in national parks. That's pretty much the focus of the program, but I want to talk about some good things going on with national parks right now. Can you talk about some projects that may be underway at some parks, and specifically the ones in the desert region, which you for the NPCA tend to focus on? Can you talk about some of those parks?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, up at Death Valley, they've got a number of different projects in the works. We're talking about putting solar panels on buildings to provide the power in remote areas. We're talking about really green projects. Mojave National Preserve as well is looking at solar-powered facilities. And not on historic buildings, but on new structures. In addition, Joshua Tree National Park is going to be working on a trail project to the 49 Palms Oasis. Now, this is a beautiful spot in Joshua Tree National Park, and there's a trail to it, but the area around the oasis is being degraded. there used to be native orchids all coming through there in May and blooming, and now there's just a small patch left because of some of that degradation. But because of some of the stimulus funding, Joshua Tree National Park is going to be able to restore that area, and people are going to be able to hike in and see areas where bighorn sheep are drinking, where there are these native fan palms, where there are native orchids in the desert. It's going to be a real benefit for some of our national parks. The main parks that I work with, Joshua Tree National Park, is about 800,000 acres, the size of Rhode Island. And then you have Mojave National Preserve, which is very much a wilderness park, and it's 1.6 million acres, and it goes from mountains where there's relic white fir forest. It has singing sand dunes that actually sing or make this kind of sweet, booming music.
Is and that then, the Kelso Dunes area?
Yeah, have you been out there? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a pretty special place. And then up to Death Valley, which is about 3.4 million acres, a great wilderness park as well. Lots of places to explore, hidden oases and streams and sweeping vistas, truly remarkable desert park. Those three parks make up 20% of the land in the lower 48 in the National Park Service. So Death Valley National Park, Mojave National Preserve, and Joshua Tree National Park are some pretty special places, and places that I personally have a great love for.
Mike, can you talk about the mission of the National Parks Conservation Association, and how long has it been around?
Our mission is really simple. It's to protect and enhance our national parks so our kids and our grandkids can enjoy them. And we were established in 1919 by the first director of the National Park Service after he left federal service. He saw a need for an organization that could work with the government and outside the government to influence policy to protect our national parks. As park rangers and people in federal service can't always comment on some of these things that are really controversial. So he established the National Parks Conservation Association. We've been around since 1919. Some people refer to us as a watchdog. I like to see us as kind of a guardian angel for the National Park Service. And we work in communities. We work in D.C. We work at all levels to help protect our national parks. Sometimes we're fighting projects. Like out at Joshua Tree, there is a proposal for the world's largest landfill surrounded on three sides by Joshua Tree National Park. We're talking about 20,000 tons of trash a day for 117 years. 20,000 tons. And right next to Joshua Tree National Park, filling up a canyon full of trash. We felt that that was inappropriate. In that case, we sued and were able to halt the project. Our victory in court is currently being appealed. So we'll see how that plays out, but we feel that that's not appropriate for our national parks, that they be essentially next to a huge garbage dump.
Was this federal land or was this private land?
It was federal land. It was Bureau of Land Management land. Mm. In fact, that land used to be part of Joshua Tree National Monument. It was cut out to be a mine, a big open pit iron mine. So we have this hole in the ground. We have railroad tracks leading up to it. So someone said, why don't we just fill that hole with trash? And that plan evolved from filling a hole with trash to filling an entire canyon full of trash. And the impacts to animals like bighorn sheep, to desert tortoises, really significant. And you can imagine placing a landfill right next to a pristine area in a national park wilderness. It's going to have some significant impacts. And Judge Robert Timlin agreed with us on that.
Are there any other threats like that facing some of the other desert national parks here in California that are on that scale or approaching it?
Yeah, there's a proposed airport for next to Mojave National Preserve, a major international airport. And that would have some significant impacts as well to wilderness. If those planes are flying over Mojave National Preserve, you're not going out there to experience a flight path. You're going out there to experience wilderness. And that would have some significant impacts to animals like bighorn sheep as well. Their ability to successfully lamb, to reproduce, would be impacted by something like an airport. So, yeah, there are definitely threats to desert national parks, but there are a lot of opportunities as well.
Who's going to fly into Mojave National Preserve unless you want to get to Essex Road faster? I mean, is it the city of Barstow that wants to build that?
No, it's the city of Las Vegas that wants to build that.
Las Vegas is nowhere near that. I mean, they are, kind of, but that's a strange arrangement.
It is, and it's something that we're working to see if there are ways we could shift that development or potentially mitigate damage or making sure that those flight paths don't go over Mojave National Preserve.
Inside Mojave National Preserve is a great California state park called Mitchell Caverns.
Yeah.
How does Mitchell Caverns work in conjunction being inside this large federal area? The state still runs, at least for the time being, the state still runs that park inside it, correct?
Absolutely. And my understanding from Mojave National Preserve staff is that they have a really close partnership. They work in partnership with Mitchell Caverns. They share staff. They steer some of the tours, the school tours, up to Mitchell Caverns. And students are able to learn from Mojave National Preserve staff about some of the unique plants and animals there, and at the same time visit those caverns. Now, what would happen if Mitchell Caverns were suddenly closed? You wouldn't have those students able to have the same experience. We think that the closure of the state parks is unacceptable, and it would have significant, serious negative impacts to our national parks. And that's just one example there out there at Mojave National Preserve.
Now, before you came to work for the NPCA, you were a Park Service employee.
Yes, I worked for about 7 years as a ranger. I met my wife working as a ranger at Mesa Verde National Park. So, yeah, I have a pretty strong connection to the National Park Service and think as an organization that it does a wonderful job of protecting these places so that future generations, our kids and our grandkids, can go to these places and enjoy them the way that we do. I think it's really important that people have access into national parks, that it's a place where all Americans, and indeed people from all over the world, feel welcome.
And it's important, I think, for people to feel invested, and they have something at stake in these parks.
Absolutely. And if, say, you're a kid from an urban area, and maybe you haven't been out there, that first time can be really powerful and really special. I know because, you know, I'm from L.A., and the first place that stimulated my imagination about the outdoors was Joshua Tree National Park. I think it can. It can inspire people, and that's some of the power of the national parks.
It's pretty impressive when you first go into Joshua Tree from the Joshua Tree entrance. It's that Wonderland of Rocks area, and it looks like these huge piles of pebbles from far away, and of course they're not. They've all been eroded away, but then you get into Lost Horse Valley. It's just an amazing, amazing place, and I can imagine being from Los Angeles, being from an urbanized area, and seeing some place like that that's so open and so wild, it must have really been quite a thrill.
It blew my mind, absolutely. And it's a privilege to be back here now in this position in helping to protect these parks. It's an absolute privilege.
You were in Northern California for a time as well, but you weren't working for the Park Service at that time, correct?
No, I was teaching at Humboldt State University and connecting some of the classes there with community service, including some environmental service. That was a great place to live and also explore some of the national parks up there like Redwood National Park and some of the state parks as well.
And I'll bet going from Southern California, being a native to Southern California, and going into the verdant wonder world of Northern California, especially Humboldt and Mendocino counties, must have been something as well.
Oh, so much to learn in terms of the plants, the animals, the ecosystems. And one time I was out on the beach, I'd hiked down to the beach, and it started snowing on the beach. There's so much out there to explore, Tommy. And I think Northern California is beautiful, but it's great to be back in the desert, too, back in Southern California.
And you were in Mesa Verde for a while as well, in Colorado.
Yeah, I worked as a ranger there and led people into these 800-year-old cliff dwellings. And my job was to talk about human culture with the backdrop of 800-year-old cliff dwellings. Definitely lucky to be able to do that. But it adds to the richness of life to have some of those experiences in around national parks and to be able to bring other people into them.
Now, the National Parks Conservation Association has a presence in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and the NPCA does advocate on behalf of the National Park Service to get funding. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We mobilize communities to say, hey, our national parks are really important. They're places where we take our families, places that we've set aside as American people for our kids and our grandkids. And it's really important they be preserved. And that message, I think, is resonating. We're looking at $134 million potentially operations increase for the National Park Service this year. And in addition, about $900 million of the stimulus money is going to be going to some much-needed projects within the National Park Service. You know, the National Park Service has an $8 billion maintenance backlog of projects that are outstanding, that they need to get done, but they don't have the funding for. So we sort of look at the stimulus as a down payment on that $8 billion maintenance backlog. It's definitely overdue, and our parks are, right now, they're out there putting people to work some of these much-needed projects that are going to protect the parks, that are going to stimulate economies, that are going to bring more people, more visitors into the parks as well. The stimulus money going to the national parks is definitely a good thing, and it's going to some really worthy projects.
Thank goodness for that. Thank goodness for that. If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. I'm Tommy Howe, and joining us today is Mike Cipra, the California Desert Program Manager for the National Parks Conservation Association. It's also known as the NPCA. You can find out more about the NPCA at www.npca.org. That's npca.org. Let's talk about the guns and national parks issue. This first came about a year ago. It was suggested at the time by Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma. The question was posed to him at the time. He said, why would you need actively need to be packing firearms in national parks? And the answer was not even related to the unlikely event that you might be attacked by a bear or a mountain lion. The answer was, you might be the victim of a violent crime in a national park. I found this to be ludicrous. I still do. It makes no sense. You are far more likely to be in a car accident on the way to a national park than you are to be a victim of some kind of violent crime. And I don't mean to take your answer, but I mean...
I'll take it a step farther from there. You're more likely to be struck by lightning than you are to be a victim of a violent crime in a national park. It's about 1 in 733,000 chance of being a victim of a violent crime when you enter a national park. They're some of the safest places you can be in our country. And I happen to know that, too, from being a park ranger. I lived and worked in parks for 7 years of my life, and I think they are a pretty safe place, a place where we bring our families. Would we bring our families if we know that the person in the tent next to us is packing heat? It's not an appropriate thing to bring a firearm to, say, a campfire evening program where there are families and kids. It's not an appropriate thing to bring it into your tent. What if someone's been drinking a little bit? And people tend to do that if they go into national parks, maybe unwind a little bit. We don't feel that it's appropriate. We don't feel that it's safe to bring these loaded weapons into the equation of national parks. It's not something that the parks need. And in fact, the American people agree. When the Bush administration proposed a rule change, they opened it up to public comment. About 140,000 people commented, and more than 70% of them did not want loaded guns in national parks. The will of the American people is not being represented by this legislation. That's really troubling to us. It's not necessarily a reflection of how people feel about parks, and yet it's been made into law.
National Park Service professionals are almost to a person against this. Are you, as a former National Park Service employee, in touch with folks you used to work with who have some feelings about this?
Absolutely. The coalition of National Park Service retirees is firmly opposed to having loaded guns in national parks. And in fact, every surviving former director of the National Park Service is opposed as well. These are people who have spent their entire lives protecting our parks, protecting our families, protecting the wildlife inside the parks, the plants, and they're opposed to having loaded guns in our national parks. I think it tells you a lot that people who are the professionals in the field are opposed to this rule change.
To say that I'm not happy about the overhaul of the Reagan-era firearms rule is not to say that me personally or this program is against the Second Amendment. I'm not.
I have to admit, I am a gun owner myself, and I'm a former park ranger. The way that I approach it is, when I enter a national park, I take the bullets out of the gun. I put the gun in the trunk because what that says is I come in peace. I come to this place, this sanctuary, in peace. It says that to my neighbors in the campground. It says that to the animals that are around. And most importantly, it's something that I say to myself. It's, I think, a really important psychological act to unload that weapon and to put it in the trunk. And it's a pretty small physical act, but it's something that has tremendous repercussions. I do think that our parks are our places of peace, and they are sanctuaries. And I don't think that at all is in conflict with the Second Amendment. I mean, you can still have a gun in a national park. All you have to do is unload it. And I think that's a really important distinction, and I'm glad that you brought that up.
And it's not asking much.
No, it's really not. And it's something that we're saying, we've set these places aside. So what are the values that are here? Why do we set them aside? We set them aside to protect things like rock art panels and animals and make sure that our families and our school kids can come inside some of these parks and have that experience as well. And I think that's not in conflict at all with the Second Amendment.
From a law enforcement standpoint, how do you think that management angle is going to change with these new rules or with these reduction of rules?
Well, I think it's going to put a lot of stress on our park rangers. I think it's going to put them in harm's way and in jeopardy. And look, I used to be a park ranger myself, and there were some situations that came up. People had been drinking, maybe got into a little bit of an argument, and I think having a loaded gun in that situation would have escalated things to a very dangerous level. I think that it's going to put additional stress, and it's going to put some of our nation's park rangers, who I think we hold in high esteem, in harm's way and in risk.
Now, what you're describing is something that would happen at a campground, because you may have a lot of people interacting. You may have someone having a beer or two, and goodness knows that's not when you need firearms around. In the backcountry, it's more likely you might see poaching issues come up.
Oh, yeah. If you look in some places on the Bureau of Land Management land where guns are allowed, you'll see out in the desert, you'll see Joshua trees that are shot up. Yeah. You'll see even petroglyph panels, rock art, stuff that's 1,000 years old, shot at. One of the saddest things I've seen is a snake that was shot. Our parks are places where we want to protect the wildlife. We want to protect the cultural history. That's why we set these places aside. And loaded guns are not going to contribute to the safety and the protection of our national parks.
Not really a component of that formula.
No, it's not appropriate for national parks. And in fact, it adds a lot of danger.
This overhaul of regulations, too, is addressing a problem which wasn't there. There was no problem with the way the rules have been for the last 25-odd years. There's really no problem with the way they'd been since 1936. So you're undoing a lot of regulations that have been working rather effectively.
I will tell you, when I lived in a national park, I never locked my door. Didn't lock the doors to my car. I never had a problem with theft. They are some of the safest places you can go. But will they be the safest places when people are packing heat, when people are locked and loaded in our national parks? I have some serious doubts about that. And it doesn't seem like good policy to change something that isn't broken. If something is working, if the national parks are established and being managed in a really safe way, why would you want to change that policy?
And for a place where Americans enjoy taking their families, for places where a lot of kids have their first experiences outdoors like you did at Joshua Tree, it just seems wholly incompatible. Wholly
absolutely. Incompatible. Okay, here's a potential scenario. And you can say it's a worst-case scenario, but what if a school group is coming into Joshua Tree National Park? And Joshua Tree National Park's education department does a fantastic job, by the way, educating about 20,000 students a year. And a lot of them, it's their first time ever inside a national park. What if on that first trip inside a national park, they come across someone who has a gun, who has a loaded gun? Do you think that those kids are going to want to come back to national parks? Do you think that that first experience is going to be a positive one? It sounds to me like it's kind of a dangerous one. And it is a little bit of a worst-case scenario, but you can see that happening. And I think for our parks to be viable in the future, our kids need to be able to go into them and have access. They need to be places where it's safe. That's kind of a minimum level. This new legislation puts that in serious jeopardy.
Animal attacks in national parks are unusual. It's my guess that if you're being stalked by a big cat, pulling out the gun is probably the wrong approach. You make yourself as big as possible. You throw rocks at the cat if you even are being stalked by a mountain lion. Bears, pretty unlikely. You kind of have to go out of your way to go find a bear unless you're hiking by yourself and you have to come across a bear just on the trail. But it seems to me that even the first response should not be pulling out a gun, a .45, and putting a couple of rounds into it.
Well, with the bear, the spray is going to be more effective than pulling out your gun. If you shoot a bear in kind of a panic situation, you might wound it and make it upset. I think the spray is going to be more effective. Mm-hmm. And I have come across a mountain lion in Mesa Verde. And what you do is it's really simple. You stand up. You make yourself as big as possible. You can make noise if you want, then slowly back away from the animal. And that's an effective strategy for dealing with it. I don't see someone being a crocodile hunter out there and being able to react to a mountain lion and shooting it. It doesn't right. seem realistic.
Well, when you have a firearm, you're sort of removing the possibility of a less than lethal circumstance in a situation which doesn't have to be that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that having a gun, you're thinking about what am I going to do? How am I going to fire this? Rather than thinking about, well, what's on the trail and what's my experience in this park and what is the relationship, this plant to this animal? You're thinking about your gun rather than thinking about your experience in the park. What's happened, Tommy, is that the courts have agreed with us and the American people have agreed with us, and somehow our legislators aren't getting that message. So we're trying to communicate with our legislators that, you know, moving forward, this rule will not go into effect until February 2010. Mm-hmm. There's still time. There's still time to create legislation to potentially change this. That might be a good thing for people to communicate to their representatives, that if they go out to national parks and they enjoy these places, maybe if you call up your congressman or congresswoman and tell them what you think. Are guns appropriate in national parks? Do you want to put your family in contact with that? Communicating to our legislators in the clearest terms possible, I think, is a great strategy moving forward. My understanding of how it applies to California is that people who have permits for concealed carry can carry guns in national parks as of February 2010. So if you've gone through the permitting process to carry a concealed weapon, then as of February 2010, if this legislation doesn't have other legislation that comes in and changes, you would be able to carry a loaded weapon, say, at a campfire program or in your tent at night or whatever you would normally be able to do in the state of California with that concealed carry permit. Now, it's a really interesting case with a state boundary that is contained within a national park. I'll give you an example. Death Valley National Park. There's a different law that governs Nevada and governs California. It seems to us that this creates more confusion than it does clarify for people. Part of the beauty of the previous Reagan-era rule was that it clarified for people, these are places, and our national parks are places that are sanctuaries, and it's not appropriate to have loaded weapons in them. We're here to protect the plants and the animals and provide for the safety of people. It seems to me adding that confusion and adding loaded guns is not the way to do it. I think what surprises me the most is the wildness of things. In going out to a place where you can hear silence, you can hear it in wind, in animals, you can hear and explore places that are truly wild. And to me, that's a rare thing, and it's becoming increasingly rare in our society. Places where you can find solitude, places where you can explore wilderness, where you can potentially bring others to it as well. That, to me, is some of the power of the desert national parks.
PBS is going to be running a documentary in September, produced and directed by Ken Burns, who, of course, did the Civil War and the baseball documentary, and also the documentary about World War II from a couple of years ago. And it's called The National Parks, America's Best Idea. What a wonderful title. Was the NPCA involved with that in any way?
Yeah, we've been working with Dayton Duncan, who wrote it, and with Ken Burns as well. Mr. Burns is an incredibly talented filmmaker. I was privileged enough to see a few hours of that film, and it's going to knock your socks off. It tells the story of the national parks both visually and also through people, through the people that affected it. And it tells some of the stories of people who changed history by setting these places aside, truly visionaries, both in terms of the environmental community and our world. And what they've left us is really rich cultural and historical and natural landscape, something that is the best of America and something that should be protected and preserved.
Mike Cipra, the California Desert Program Manager for the National Parks Conservation Association, extremely nice having you on the program. I'm so glad you're able to make it down here today and talk with us. And I know you're in town doing some business, so have a safe drive back to 29 Palms. Thanks again. We will talk to you next time.
Thanks a lot, Tommy. It was a real privilege.
That's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International on FM 94.9. I'm Tommy Howe. Thanks again to Mike Sipra, the California Desert Program Manager from the National Parks Conservation Association's California Desert Field Office in Joshua Tree. Many thanks to Mike for stopping by while he was in town. To learn more about the National Parks Conservation Association and concerns over the new law, which will allow loaded guns in national parks, as well as how you can help preserve and take care of national parks and National Park Service lands important to you and near your home, go to www.npca.org. That's www.npca.org for the National Parks Conservation Association. For additional information regarding the 2009 credit card reform legislation, which has now cleared the way for loaded weapons in national parks, you can also go to the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence website at www.bradycampaign.org. That's bradycampaign.org. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of FM 94.9 or Lincoln Financial Media. And as producer, I am solely responsible for this program's content. Questions, complaints, concerns, compliments, we'd love to hear from you. The email is tommy@fm949sd.com. And for more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, you can go to the Tree Huggers International page at the FM 94.9 website, which is back at its old URL, www.fm949sd.com/treehuggers. fm949sd.com/treehuggers. Or just find the Tree Huggers International logo at the FM 94.9 website, click on it, and it'll take you over there. This is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 5:30 with another take on natural science and environmental affairs in our corner of Southern California. But in the meantime, get ready for another edition of Nina Blackwood's New Wave Nation. It's on the way next on FM 94.9. Have a great Sunday and a good week. Be well.